I've done a fair bit of work on addiction over the last few years, a lot of it with Kent Berridge at Michigan. And there we've mainly been, I mean, he does the experiments, right? He's one of the main people researching in this area. But we've together been sort of thinking of a more philosophical presentation of the sort of action theory there. What I haven't thought about before very much are some of the ethical implications of that. So what I really want to do today is to think about the ethical implications of that account of addiction. But of course, if you're going to understand those, you need to know the account of addiction first. So the first half, I'm going to talk about stuff which, my apologies to people who've heard me speak on this before, is stuff I've done over a number of years. And then in the second half, it's some more novel stuff on the ethical implications. I'm not going to start with an anecdote this time. I'm going to go straight in. But let me start by talking about, I think, a very common disagreement in much of the literature and much of the public discussion about addiction. Well, there tends to be a real polarization between two camps of people, one of whom think that addictive behavior is basically just like any other kind of behavior. Should be thought of in those ways, should be penalized in the same kind of way. It's just an ordinary behavior motivated by belief, desire, psychology, in the way that most behaviors are motivated. In the other camp stand people who say, no, addiction is an illness. And because of that, because it's an illness, it involves a complete loss of agency. So the addict is not really acting, they are just responding to their illness. And consumption of the addictive substances is as much a response to that illness as, you know, any coughing, if you've got whooping cough or whatever, something which is just looks like a straightforward physiological response to an illness that you have. And that debate has become very, very polarized. I think that neither of those two gets it quite right. I think we need to say that there's something right in each of those. So the first thing I want to do is to talk about what's right about each side and think about how the research evidence, admittedly research evidence done mainly on rats, but I think there's a lot to be known about human addiction from looking at rodent addiction, how that spells out. Okay, so let's look at the reasons for buying the two kinds of account. So firstly, why might you think that addictive behavior is not really compelled behavior, that it's actually behavior just like any other? A lot of reasons for thinking this. So one of the main things is that addictive behavior seems to show a very similar price elasticity of demand to any other kind of behavior. That is, as the price goes up, consumption goes down. And it doesn't just go down amongst people who are just trying out the drugs. It looks like it goes down amongst people who are heavily addicted. So this has been known since the First World War in Scandinavia, just after the First World War. Taxes were increased massively on alcohol, up 700% in some cases. What they saw was a rapid decrease in consumption, also a rapid decrease in consumption on the part of the people who were already alcoholic. So what you were seeing was a rapid fall off in the kind of complications that alcoholism was bringing. You might think, well, people were just priced out of the market, they just couldn't afford the alcohol if it had gone up that much. But a lot of studies since have suggested that it isn't like that. It's not that people get priced out, it's that they think at a certain price it's just not worth it, and they stop consuming. So that makes it look, you know, like any other good. Second thing, if you look at the prognosis for people with addiction, if you look at a sample taken from an addiction clinic, the prognosis looks really, really bad. If, however, you look at the general population and look at the addictive behavior there, the prognosis looks a lot less bad. So there's very interesting work done on this by Gene Heyman, who looks at these big national health studies in the States where you're following a cohort of people through. And what he finds on those, in stuff which looks pretty good results, and they've been corroborated by later studies, is that the typical path of addiction involves someone becoming addicted in their late teens, early 20s. That's the most typical path. And the addiction continues through their 20s and then gets lost. They give up on it in their late 20s, early 30s. So there are a lot of people who go through that and come out the other side, and they come out of it without medical help. They just give up. And of course, you lose those if what you're looking at is the population in the clinics, because the population in the clinics are often really desperate. So you're getting a rather unusual sample there. But equally, the population in the clinics often have huge comorbidity with other psychiatric illnesses. So it's not obvious what it is that's ended up with them getting into the clinics. It could be that really this is a psychiatric issue, which has been somewhat masked by the addiction, which they are more vulnerable to as a result of those psychiatric problems. Okay, so that's the stuff on one side. On the other side, if you look at the sort of rational choice models that people who cite that first kind of data give, those rational choice models just do not fit the behaviour very well at all. So a standard rational choice model says that what happens in addiction is that people consume the stuff and they get addicted in the sense that they will get a bad withdrawal symptom if they stop consuming. Okay, we're still thinking about rational choice now, because you now think about how desirable is it to go through withdrawal. And if you have a steep enough discount curve, that is, you worry more about yourself now than you do about yourself in the future, you think, well, it's really not worth it. So that's the sort of standard model various economists have pushed, and many of these sort of rational choice people have pushed for why people maintain an addiction, even though it's doing them so much damage. That really doesn't fit the data, though. So what you find, if that were the right model, you would think that someone who had been addicted and had gone through withdrawal would be the best placed person never to relapse, right? Because the person who's been through withdrawal knows how bad the addiction was, knows how bad withdrawal was, and now they're through it, right? So they have all the information to never get themselves back into that state. And yet if you look at the population that's most vulnerable, it's the population that's just come through withdrawal, right? The risk of relapsing diminishes as you get further away from coming through withdrawal. And those people with the risk of re-addiction is extremely high. So people go away to clinics, they get sorted out, they come back, and then they start consuming again straight away. Moreover, coming back and starting consuming straight away highlights another thing which is extremely well attested, both for human beings and for animal non-human animal subjects, which is that addictions are extremely cue-dependent. So addictions will be triggered by experiencing the cues which had been earlier associated with that addiction. That can be all kinds of things. That can be the friends that you used to take the drugs with. It can be the particular physical environment. It can be things like the sight of a bare arm if you're used to injecting. It can perhaps be internally stimulated cues, so just thinking about things. But it looks as though those cue dependencies are absolutely crucial in the ongoing addiction. Okay, so, and moreover, that's not just habitual, right? It's not just that people are in the habit. So there are some discussions of this where people think that addicts are just in the habit of consuming, they need to be got out of that. But there's a huge contrast between standard habitual behavior and addictive behavior. So, you know, if you walk home by a certain route, and today you think you'll walk home by a different route because you've got a letter to post, you might nonetheless walk home by the normal route, right? And you get home and you find the letter in your pocket. You know, darn it, I meant to take the other route. We do that all the time, those things. We get into a loop and we just act. Addictive behaviour isn't like that. With the person with the letter in the pocket, if you tap them on the shoulder at the point at which they're going to take the wrong route and say, hang on, you can... Right? There's no craving left to continue down the route. It's just, you just reorient yourself and go the other way. Whereas with addiction, you can remind people as much as you like. It doesn't stop, doesn't make the cravings go away. So we need a much more complex model, and we need a model which fits both of these. So how do we think about it? Well, one big breakthrough in addiction research was the discovery that dopamine, especially mesolimbic dopamine activity, is centrally involved in these addictive substances. So there was a while when people thought it might not be there in cannabis, but it is there in cannabis. It's there in caffeine, it's there in alcohol, it's there in heroin. Any drug, basically, that people get addicted to interferes with the mesolimbic dopamine system by basically boosting the signal in some way by artificially, you know, looking like the dopamine, or by stopping uptake, or by interfering with the reactors so that the receptors so that they're more receptive. So it does it myriad different ways, but it seems to be affecting that system. One class of drugs that don't do that, hallucinogenic drugs, LSD, they don't do that. But LSD doesn't look to be addictive in the same way. And certainly rats, who will get addicted to everything in that earlier list I gave you, are not interested in LSD. They will, you can offer it to them and they will not take it. So what's happening one other little thing, let me just mention one other little thing about the rat behavior, and we'll come back to this again later. Rats are not terribly interested even in cocaine or the kind of drugs that you think of as terribly addictive. They're interested in them if they've got nothing else to do. Right? So if you put a rat in a lab and you just give it amphetamines and it has nothing else to do, it will consume the amphetamines and it will develop an addiction. If you put rats in rat heaven, so there is an area where they can run on rat wheels and find other rats and have sex and play and mess around, the majority of the rats are not interested. They'll sample the amphetamines or codeine or whatever it is that you're giving them, but they won't get addicted. It's around between 5 and 10% seem to be vulnerable to the addiction. Somewhat heritable. Very similar figures to those you get for most drug addictions in human beings. That is, you don't get 100% addiction rates, unless you're looking at environments which are so awful that that's the only way out. Right? So you saw that in the Vietnam War. Very high addiction rates, many of which seemed to have been prompted by the environments that people found them in, and a diminution of that when people came back. Although there's controversy as to how much that was substituted into other things, but we can leave that for now. Okay, so it looks like those rat models have got some plausibility as a good model for what's happening in the human subjects, at least in the immediate effects. An early view on this was that what was happening is that the dopamine was hijacking the pleasure system. Right? What dopamine does on this view is it makes things really nice, you really enjoy them. So that's why people take the drugs, because they get more pleasure from this than they get from any of the other things. And if you think of people as basically hedonistically motivated, that's what's doing it. Okay. Of course, that in a way, that's still a rational choice explanation, right? Because it's just that the drug gives you a large amount of pleasure, and pleasure is the thing you want. So it's an instrumental desire for the intrinsic good of pleasure. Okay. That, however, has been, I think, pretty much totally discredited as the role that dopamine is playing. Instead, it looks as though there is a radical disconnect between the wanting system and the liking system. Pleasure is liking, right? It's on the liking side. Dopamine is on the wanting side. That's not to say that addictive substances are not often liked, because of course what happens here is that both things are triggered. But it's that what the dopamine is doing is the wanting, and that means there is a potential dissociation between liking and wanting in these cases, even though very often with these addictive drugs they do both. So let me just say a little bit about the evidence for that. So I say this is predominantly with rat studies. You can make a rat dopamine depleted in two different ways. You can either genetically engineer it so that its dopamine system doesn't work properly, or you can give it a dopamine antagonist which stops it taking up dopamine. If you do that with the rat and you make the rat very hungry, you can put it in front of food and it won't consume the food, at least very, very little food consumption. If you take the food and put it in its mouth, you will get signs of pleasure. How do you measure the signs of pleasure? Well, there are facial expressions which rats and other mammals demonstrate. This is the work that Ken Berridge has done. I'm tempted to say little sort of ratty smiles, but that's not quite right. But if you have a look on Berridge's website, there are these videos of these things. These seem to be pretty much universal across mammal subjects. So you get them in rats, you get them in elephants, you get them in human beings, you get them in neonatal human beings, and you get them again with dementia. It looks as though we probably learn to repress them for much of our lives. But those are very good indicators of a pleasure response. So you get a pleasure response from the food when it's put into the rat's mouth, even though if its dopamine system is compromised, it isn't motivated to get it. If you put a cannula into its brain so that you can put amphetamines in and then stimulate the dopamine system again, you get an immediate uptake of activity consuming the substance. And then as you switch the tap off on that cannula, it just goes back to base level again. So it seems to be very, very responsive to that. And there's a huge raft of evidence for that. Okay, so what's happening there? What's going on? Well, as I say, at the neurophysiological level, there's now some evidence on exactly what is happening. Both of the what's happening is happening in the nucleus accumbens, but there are different sets of signals. There's the dopamine signal, and there is also a set of signals from natural opiates and from cannabinoids. All those three signals are sent out in the face of the consumption, typically. What the opiates and the cannabinoids are doing is basically running the pleasure system, and they're activating different spots in the nucleus accumbens. Whereas what the dopamine is doing, actually with, again, those other two, but unique to the dopamine, is hitting the wanting system. Okay, now what does that wanting system do? Well, it does two things, and this is going to be important in some of the stuff I'll talk about later. Firstly, it gives rise to an immediate consumptive urge, right? That is, you go for the thing. As the dopamine signal comes in, you go for the thing and you consume it. But secondly, it gives rise to a long-run disposition, which is to go for that thing when you witness it in the future. So what it does is gives rise to a cued behavior of later consumption on the basis of whatever it was that the rat was seeing when it got the dopamine signal. Okay, so it's two different things that are happening there. One is immediate movement towards get it. The other is a long-term sensitization of the creature to later consumption, to perform later consumption in the light of seeing that cue. Okay, so what happens with addictive behavior? What happens, standard account here, is that with addictive behavior, because you get that hijacking of the dopamine system, that is, the dopamine system over-responds, it can do that independently of there being any pleasure there. But you will still have the wanting. It's the converse of the genetically engineered rat who has no dopamine system that gets pleasure without any wanting. The addictive subject gets the wanting without necessarily having any pleasure that goes with it. Okay, think about why this is. Why is this evolved? Well, clearly it's a kind of learning, right? But it's not learning in the sense of learning information, right? It's not evidential learning, anything like that. What you're learning is a certain new desire. You learn to want something as a result of being exposed to it. But crucially, this is not an instrumental want, right? It's not here that the subject wants the substance in order to get pleasure later, or not pleasure later, pleasure then, right? It's not an instrumental desire in order to achieve this intrinsic desire of the pleasure from the thing. It is a formed intrinsic desire. So you gain new intrinsic desires as a result of the earlier exposure that you had to it. And you can see it's pretty clear why that would have evolved, right? I mean, imagine one thing that we have in common with rats is that we are extremely opportunistic in our feeding behaviours. Right? I always contrast us with koala bears, koalas, right? Koalas, they eat four different kinds of eucalyptus leaf. And that's it. And if they can't get those eucalyptus leaves, they're in real trouble. That's what they're primed to get, and they go for those. We like rats, and this is one of the reasons why rats are such a good model, we'll go around sampling all kinds of things, and that's part of our success, and lay down wants for those things if they benefit us. And what you're finding here is a misfiring for those addictive drugs of the things which are benefiting us, because in effect it's managed to impersonate the cues that should have been given by something that was good for you. Okay, so that's the basic framework. Why doesn't that, what I've said so far though, might make you think that this is compelled action, right? Because you see the thing and you go for it. And that's basically what you have in rats. But that's probably because rats don't have much of a self-control possibility. Right? Human subjects do have self-control in the following sense. That it seems that what the dopamine signal is doing is giving rise to a very strong craving. Right? By craving, I mean the kind of desire which manages to focus you, typically in three different dimensions. It manages to focus you on this thing rather than any other thing. It manages to focus you on this thing now rather than in the future. So, notoriously, addicts' behavior tends to show disregard for future consumption because you're going for consumption now. And it focuses attention on this stuff for you and not this stuff for other people around you. Again, addictive behavior tends towards a certain kind of selfishness because the nature of that craving is to focus that desire in. But it doesn't lead straight to behavior, because you can overcome those desires if you are sufficiently motivated to do so. One of the awful things about many addictive substances is that the incentives for giving up on them are actually typically long run and diffuse, whereas the rewards, at least the craving, is coming here and now. Interestingly, again, experimentally, there are therapies which are remarkably successful, much more successful than you would think, which try and give an immediate incentive. So there's a project done in a number of US clinics which is politically extremely unpopular, but clinically a very effective intervention, which is that you pay addicts for coming in clean, and you pay them a small amount to begin with, and that amount increases each time they come in clean. So they know that if they consume in the meanwhile, the cost for consumption will go up. And these are relatively small amounts of money. They often plateau at about $20. And yet they have a remarkable effect on the subjects concerned. In fact, they've even done it with chocolate as the reward, and you get much more response than you would think. So what you're doing is managing to change the motivational structure so that you've got an immediate payoff, which is such that people are engaged to do it. But it doesn't mean to say it isn't hard work. It can be terribly hard work with these addictive drugs. So if you look at the sort of standard physiological arousal indicators of how much work the people are doing, they are working like mad to try and resist in many of these cases. So the question shouldn't be, you know, is an agent compelled or not compelled, where compelled is thought of as this absolute thing. The question should rather be, how hard is it for an agent to give up? Is it an easy thing, or is it a very difficult thing which will need a lot of motivation and a lot of support? And the evidence is that with many of these drugs, it's a very difficult thing to do. Hence the tendency to relapse, because of course what happens when you're dried out is that indeed you get through withdrawal, but you don't lose that long-run tendency to form the craving on the basis of being stimulated with the relevant cues. So that's why when addicts go and dry out somewhere and they come back into the same environment that they were in before, they have such a tendency to succumb. Okay, so how do you explain I think that's explained most of the things we started with, right? I won't go through them, but it gives that model of how you can have something which is, in a sense, pathological, but in another sense, does respond to price elasticities and things like that. What about this finding that over the age of 30, a lot of these addictions seem to be stopped by the agent's own decision rather than by medical help? Well, there are three different possible explanations there. One, which Ken Berridge favours himself, is that dopamine levels just decrease as we get older. He calls this the long march to Parkinson's. Right? Parkinson's is a dopamine deficiency problem. So by the time you've hit your 30s, your dopamine levels are already much lower than they were when you were in your teens and 20s. That's one possibility. Another possibility, of course, is that the motivation to stop gets stronger. That is, people in their 30s have very often got a partner, they might have kids, they might have a job that matters to them, they might have seen their friends suffering badly from addiction around them. So the set of reasons they have for giving up may be such as to motivate them and, you know, boost the reasons for giving up. The third possibility is that the self-control gets stronger. This is a little bit more contentious, but there is good evidence that insofar as self-control is a frontally realized activity, that those brain structures are probably maturing. There's a bit of a gender gap here in women up until their mid-20s and in men up until their late 20s. So there is possibly some impact of that as well. Or it may well be all three of those muddled up in some way. All right, that's what I want to say about the basis of addiction, how I understand it. Let's think about the ethics of it, though. Now let's think about what conclusions one can draw on the basis of this. And I want to discuss two different areas. Firstly, I want to talk about the extent to which understanding these kinds of mechanisms has an impact on the way we should think about the authority of desire. And then second, I want to think about how we should think about the kind of environments in which people find themselves and where we should think responsibility falls with respect to those environments. So let's start thinking about the significance of preferences. As you know, there are many accounts which think of preferences as being the basic measure of what? Well, satisfaction of preferences, the basic measure of well-being, something like that, basic welfare thing. Or that you think the government policy should be basically devoted towards the maximization of preference satisfaction, or something like that. I think once you think this way about how these intrinsic desires have come about, it is extremely difficult to think of desire there as having any particular authority. Right? Okay, you fulfill the people's desires. There is no guarantee that they're going to get any pleasure from desire fulfillment. That was the thing we saw. They don't even need to believe they're going to get pleasure from the desire fulfillment. Addicts very often say that. Actually, there was a review in The Guardian I was reading today by John Crace, I don't know how you say his name, C-R-A-C-E, saying when he was an addict, he used to consume all these things he didn't like. Yeah, addicts say that all the time. People tend to dismiss it. They think, oh, it's just another story that addicts are telling. It's probably literally true, because there needs to be no anticipated pleasure. The craving has just been dissociated from that. Moreover, it's been dissociated not just from the pleasure, it's been dissociated from the more cognitive attitudes that people might have about what would be a good thing to do. That's what's so dreadful about these things. You can think that going on consuming would be awful. You think it would be damaging to you, damaging to the people you love, damaging to your career, damaging many, many different ways, and yet still be motivated to do it because those cravings have got a life which is running independently of the more cognitive attitudes you have. I mean, think about this in other cases, right? I mean, suppose, you know, some new gadget comes out, you know, the iPhone 10 Plus or whatever it is, and you read all the reviews. I mean, you see the adverts and you think, wow, that's great. And you start lusting for the thing. And then you read the reviews of it, and they all say, this is a complete monster, right? It doesn't work. You know, what do Apple think they're doing, trying to cream money off people for this? You'd do much better with an iPhone 3. You know, don't buy it, people. It's not then that you still feel this ongoing desire for the 10X or whatever it was I called it. The desire just goes away once you realize that the thing isn't going to do, isn't desirable, right? It's a much more cognitive desire. At least that's my attitude towards iPhones. I appreciate some people are so deeply into some of these products that maybe they get something that's more akin to the addictive thing. But I think for most of us, right, once you have that knowledge, the desire just isn't there. It just fades away. That's not there for these dopamine-driven, addictive-style desires. You can have the knowledge that the thing is going to do you harm. That means you have to try and overcome the desire. It doesn't mean that the knowledge undermines that desire, such that it's something that you no longer need to overcome. Okay, so once you think of it that way, why on earth would you have a policy that just in general thought that the satisfaction of preferences is what we should be doing? Because why are these preferences there? Well, they're just there because the people consumed this stuff and it gave rise to that preference. It seems to have no authority whatsoever. So you might say, well, let's launder the preferences. And this, of course, is a standard maneuver amongst sort of preference-based utilitarians and the like. Well, how would you launder the preference? Well, you might say, you should only take the desires which are fully informed. Well, that's not going to help here. The whole point is that these are desires that persist in the face of full information. Or you might say, well, you should take the desires that you would have if you were fully rational. Well, again, that's not going to help, because there's no reason for thinking that, I mean, there might be some sense in which having consuming an addictive substance is an irrational thing to do. But it needn't be, right? I mean, it's not the irrationality. It's not the rationality which is making you do it. It's not an indication of irrationality that you're going on consuming. It's an indication of your responding to a desire which is isolated from the rationality. So there's no particular reason for thinking that your fully rational self, if you're using them as a model, would be any more immune to addiction than you would be. Maybe then you say, well, it's the advice model. Sort of Michael Smith way of thinking of this. It's not what you see the fully rational self modeling. It's the fully rational self would give you advice on what to do. Well, but this is tricky, right? Why would the fully rational self give you advice not to consume? Well, presumably because they think that they don't want you to have those desires. Well, why don't they want you to have the desires? Well, because they think it's a bad thing for you to do. Well, that's just what you yourself can be thinking. You might say, well, no, it's not that. It's that they desire for you not to have those desires. It's not just that they think it's wrong. It's we should be looking to their desires for your desire. Well, do they have such desires? That actually takes us to the third possible account, which is the higher order desire account, which I mentioned with Jeff last night. So Harry Frankfurt, who with Dick Jeffrey was the originator of this way of thinking of things, actually uses addicts as his example. So he says there are two different sorts of addict. There's the willing addict and there's the unwilling addict. The willing addict desires the good and desires to desire the good. Whereas the unwilling addict desires the good but doesn't desire to desire it. So their higher level desires are out of line, their second order desires there are out of line with their first order desires. So you could say, we should launder the desires in line not with just the first order desires, but in line with the second order desires. That should be our basic laundering technique. Okay, well, let's think about this in the context of the stuff I've been talking about. I mean, first thing to say, it's not good enough that people have higher order desires not to have the desire. It has to be the case that their higher order desire not to have it is stronger than any higher order desire they have to have it. Right. Actually, when Frankfurt's talking about it, it's not just to do with strength, it's to do with desire for the desire being the desire that does the work. But that takes us in an even more complicated area. So let's just, we'll just think in terms of strength, which I think is good enough to make the point. So it's not enough to say that the unwilling addict desires not to desire. The unwilling addict must have the desire not to desire stronger than the desire to desire, right? And presumably vice versa for the willing addict on the Frankfurt program. Okay, now why should we think that their strongest desire, strongest second-order desire, is the desire not to desire? Frankfurt never goes beyond the idea that you just sort of ask them. And they say this. But, you know, the model we're in, for pretty good reason, is that just asking people what they want is not a terribly good indication of what they want, especially not if you're looking in an area where your desires might be playing havoc with the lives of other people around you. Right? So you need to look for something that's more behavioural. At least, that might not be the be-all and end-all, but at least it's a very good first pass. And that, of course, is what Berridge does with the rats. He looks to see whether they go for the stuff or not. That's the measure of desire. So what's going to be the measure we have of the higher order desire that the subjects have? Well, if a desire is getting the thing, then a desire for a desire presumably is getting something which gets you the thing. Well, let's go back to the addict. What happens with the addict? Well, I said there are two things that happen as a result of this dopamine stimulation. One of them is actually moving to get the stuff. The other is laying down a long-term disposition, which is such that when they see the stuff, they'll move to get it. So insofar as we've actually got a kind of well-understood, neurophysiologically well-represented thing there that looks like a higher order desire, that looks like a higher order desire, right? It's a, what they're in is in a state which is such that it will give rise to desires when they're stimulated by the relevant cue. And that is increased every time they consume the good. So that desire looks to be the thing which is strongest when they consume it. Now, of course, it's also true that people who are addicted, very often when they're not being cued for the desire, will not want the thing. Right? So addicts will sign in to programs to get themselves off the addiction. Alcoholics will take antabuse. Antabuse is a substance which, when you consume alcohol, makes you feel nauseous. They will consume that in an attempt to stop themselves consuming the alcohol later. So you might say, well, look, that's evidence of higher order desire, isn't it? Well, but hang on, I don't think we even need higher order desires there. What that shows is that when they're not being cued for the substance, they don't want to drink it, right? Or they don't want their future self to drink it, or their cued self to drink it. That's a straightforward first order desire. There may be a second order desire that goes along with that, but it's that first order desire, not to be taking it later, which is the one you need to explain the behaviour that they are exhibiting. So I don't think moving to higher order desires will do the job of laundering the right desires to be the ones that we should be respectful of. In fact, I don't think there's any clear way, if you're just looking at desires, to do the work. Right? You've got instead to move, well, there are two different ways. You could either go towards a more hedonistic model, and you could say, well, look, it's pleasure that matters, and these addicts aren't getting pleasure. Or you could go towards a more cognitive model. Okay, I could talk quite a lot about the pleasure stuff, and time probably won't let me, but let me just outline why I think one should be a little bit skeptical of the pleasure stuff. Again, if we take seriously what the neurophysiology, at least as we understand it at the moment, is telling us. So, of course, there might be a bit of a mystery as to why we've got this dissociation of wanting and liking. In fact, why on earth would we have the liking? Right? Because the model I describe looks like it's good enough just to think of us as driven by the wanting, and the liking looks like this epiphenomenal fluff. Right? I mean, why on earth have we got it there? Well, there are some views on this. One view is that liking is there as a universal currency to bring all the different wants in together. Right, but that can't be right, because as we've just seen, at least if it's a universal currency, it's not a very effective one, because you don't have to have liking in order to be motivated to display the behaviour. Much more plausible, a line from Tony Dickinson, which at least I have a lot of sympathy with, is the idea that the reason that pleasure is there is because mammals, possibly birds, but maybe from a different evolutionary system, are not simply driven by these stimulus response style desires that we've been talking about. Right? Mammals have projects, and the projects involve a representation of the thing they're after. These are model-based learning, to use the jargon that's become popular recently, a representation of what you're after, and a plan to try and get it. But that is separate to this stimulus response system which I've been talking about so far with the dopamine-based learning to want. So if you had beings where those two things kept coming radically apart, you would find that the beings kept tripping themselves up. Right? Because one system would be going one way and the other system would be going the other way. Dickinson has an anecdote, so I can give you an anecdote, finally, from an experience he had in Palermo as a young student, arriving in Palermo and having for the first time watermelon. This was, I think, the early, mid-60s, so, you know, watermelon was a particularly exotic thing for a young Englishman to have. Thought it was absolutely wonderful. Went out that night, got completely hammered on the local red wine, spent the whole of the rest of the day hungover from it. Towards the evening, he decided he needed something to make himself feel a bit better and thought some of that nice watermelon would be the thing to have. Went down to the docks to get it, took one bite and had a complete repulsion from it. When he did more psychology, he realized what it was, that if you've poisoned yourself, your body has a response which stops you consuming the foods you consumed just before you had the poisoned response, right? But your body's quite canny. It selects between new foodstuffs and regular foodstuffs. He'd had plenty of red wine in the past, so his body selected the watermelon as the culprit for what was going on here, even though the watermelon, of course, was utterly innocent in the hangover he'd been experiencing that day. So what you had there was a dissociation between his stimulus response systems, in this case not a wanting, but a disgust response, a not wanting response, and his more cognitive planning. What happened, though, was because he found it disgusting when he ate it, that's a, you know, the opposite of a kind of pleasure response, is that he now had something go into his planning system from this other system, right? That is, pleasure and displeasure can be seen as the route by which the stimulus response system manages to get a little surrogate goal into the goal system. And people get the idea. If you don't get the idea, we can talk about it in question. If that's the right way to think about it, though, well, pleasure is a really interesting thing. But again, the significance of pleasure for what it is that we should be trying to achieve now looks, you know, why on earth should we be after that? Of course, there can be other things. You can feel glad about something. You can feel satisfied in certain ways. But those are probably much more cognitive measures. So I think in all these things, what this evidence is pushing us to is away from a desire or a preference or pleasure-based measure of good and towards something which is much more focused on a cognitive belief-like element. Okay, I'm not going to fill in that. I just wanted to make that sort of negative case. Secondly, the polluted environment. Okay, there has been much debate recently about whether or not we should think of the attitude people have towards sugar, towards sucrose, as like an addiction. Well, first thing is, sucrose does not seem to have anything in it like the addictive drugs, which artificially stimulates the dopamine system. Right? It doesn't get in there and fiddle with it in some funny way in the way that cannabis or these other things do. On the other hand, sugar is much liked and seems to use the dopamine system in exactly the way the dopamine system had evolved to work. Right? It just doesn't do it by a backdoor hijacking way. It does it through the front door standard way that that system had evolved to do it. You can get rats very taken with sugar so that they will consume sugar. Actually, they'll consume much more sugar than they will most of the addictive drugs. So there are a lot of nice experiments showing that rats are much more vulnerable to what you might think of as a sugar addiction. Okay, but that means when we're thinking about addiction, there are two very different ideas here. One is to do with the etiology, right? Did you get those cravings as a result of your dopamine system being hijacked by some substance which is working through a way that the system had not evolved to do it, an illegitimate way in, if you like? If so, if that's your notion of addiction, then sugar is not addictive. If, on the other hand, your thought is, do you get these incentive salience style cravings whereby once you have been cued for it, you get this intrinsic desire, which is quite disconnected to your views about the worth of the thing you're consuming? Well, in the case of sugar, absolutely. So I think the debate there as to whether or not sugar is an addictive substance is just based on an equivocation as to whether or not we think of the etiology as being important or whether we think of the resultant state as being important. Let's focus on the resultant state, and let's focus first on addictive drugs and then we'll come back to sugar. Suppose someone had been addicted and they go to a clinic and they get themselves off and then they come back and someone waves whatever substance it was they were addicted to in their face. Right. For most of us, I think that's the paradigm of appalling behaviour on the part of the person who was waving it in their face. Right? We think it's the fault of the person who's doing it, right? You need to provide an environment for the person which doesn't trigger those kinds of cravings. So kind of picking up from the themes yesterday I was talking about providing stimuli that enable people with dementia to respond in memory-like ways, that there's some obligation there. Here I'm thinking the converse with these desire-based things, there's an obligation not to provide the kind of stimuli which give rise to this response. Now, I think a very natural way of modelling this or thinking about it is by thinking of a model of pollution. Right. If someone is vulnerable to a pollutant which maybe gives rise to bronchial problems for them, right, and someone else pumps that pollutant out, right, we think that it's the person who's polluting the environment who is responsible now for cleaning it up. And that's our general view towards pollution. And in fact, the law on pollution has moved. So the law on pollution used to be a torts issue. It used to be an issue between the person who was doing the polluting and the individual who had a nuisance claim against them. Right? So that person would have to say, you know, he sent his smoke across my field and made it really unpleasant for me, and therefore I can have something to stop him. That's moved. So our current thinking about pollution is not torts-based. It's not based on an individual complaining about this and having to show that that had happened to them. It's the other way. We think, no, we're looking at the environment and we're thinking that a polluting environment should be stopped whether or not we can show that anyone has actually been harmed by it. So the burden of proof moves the other way. And in fact, in many cases, we have a strict liability view of this. In fact, the classic strict liability, you know, if you're teaching intro law and you want the strict liability offence, polluting the water supply is the classic late 19th century strict liability offence, right? Doesn't matter whether you meant to, doesn't matter what you were trying to do, if you pollute the water supply, you are liable for what's happened there. I think that's the way we should be thinking about these kinds of desires. I think it's already the way we think about it pretty much with, heroin or something like that. But I think extending that to sugar is a very natural next step, right? If you provide an environment where you can't get past the till in a supermarket without walking past a large quantity of chocolate, and that is triggering people's desires for those things, then you are doing just the same kind of thing as if you pollute an environment with smoke that causes people who are vulnerable to it to choke. Okay, are there disanalogies? Well, there are two obvious ones. In the first place, people want the chocolate, right? Maybe they like it as well. Very often people want it. Certainly I have this, I'm sure many people have it. You eat more chocolate than you really like because the wanting kind of outstrips the liking there. So I think you actually, we witness this in these kind of cases quite trivial. I think that's quite a mundane thing that people are aware of. Well, that's true. Of course, they do want the chocolate. And to that extent, it's unlike many of the pollution cases, because many, very few people want to be coughing and choking. But as we've seen, the wants there are wants which are particularly dissociated from any kind of cognitive control that the agents might have over them. Now, in the case of chocolate, I think there's a very good case for making chocolate available for people if they want to go and get it. Right. What you don't want is for it to be made over-available so that it's there for when they wouldn't have wanted to get it if it hadn't been that it was being provided there and then. You know, a classic model for this is sort of Scandinavian ways of thinking about alcohol. Right. You don't make alcohol available at every supermarket. You make alcohol available in certain places, and people have got to go expressly to those places to get it. So, you know, maybe you should put constraints on where the chocolate is so that, of course, it's available to people. They can go and get it. But they've got to expressly go there, and it doesn't just keep coming to them. Okay, that's the first thought. Second thought. In the case of the pollutant, you can't help breathing. Whereas in the case of the chocolate, you can help consuming. Yes, that's right. So again, I think there's a difference of degree here. But of course, in the case of the pollutant, you know, if the pollution's in the city, you can move to the countryside. It's just that we don't think that that burden falls on the individual to get themselves away from the pollutant, right? It's not up to them to get away. It's up to the polluter to stop the pollution being there. So the fact you could do something about it is not by itself a reason for thinking that the burden is discharged. And I think it's the same thing here. I mean, people could do things about it. They could resist. But my point earlier on was that resistance is hard work. It's very difficult for people to resist. So we shouldn't be expecting people to resist if we can change the environment such that they don't need to. And there again, I think it's very parallel to the case with the pollutant. All right, that's what I've got to say. That's my time, so let me stop.